The first wife.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I bet that's what happened then. Alan can't talk to her into doing it then.
Huh. He wrote to me and asked me to do an article, but I didn't feel that I had the resources at the time to undertake it, so I turned him down.
Well, let's go back to the NSF job.
Yes. One of my functions was to keep in touch with what was going on, and it was based on my... in addition to the NSF job, I was doing this second edition of the punch card book with Perry and Casey, and now, how did Perry get to Washington at that time? I guess he came down from Cleveland different times, mm-hmm. But we worked together on the book. I wrote a chapter, and I also collected chapters and so forth. And in the process was keeping in touch with a lot of people who were using punch cards and early computers and so forth, like Claire Schultz and Gene Garfield and Saul Herner and so forth. And we decided to collect this information in these two booklets, that I told you. And you have...
Non-conventional systems.
Yes, non-conventional systems, which I... you have Lee Bonert's,
right.
Then this is Wooster's.
I'll get that one. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I have a copy of that.
Yeah. Well, you don't have that in your bibliography.
No. Right. Neither one of them are in there.
Yeah. This is.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
That's what made me. That's what I noticed. That it was that Lee's was in there, but Harold's wasn't. And you may want to.
Yes, definitely,
yeah,
I do.
Yeah. 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 Bonert is under.
Yes,
in the encyclopedia.
Right.
Yeah,
she wrote Wooster it.
Isn't. Yeah. And 57, and like he told, I told you that the first edition was Harold called it a poorly typed, locally reproduced 22-page fascicle, and then the informal beginning of a series which started formally a year later, which I do believe the publication of number one was a better better reproduced version of the first one. And in the first edition of the non-conventional systems published in January 58, 30 systems and 25 organizations, and I visited all of them and actually saw them in operation and talked to the special librarians or the SciTech information people that were operating the system, and helped to produce the descriptions. But then they grew, I forget how many she said were 150 or something like that in the last.
Right.
And by that point, there were too many in current operation to try to cover them all, so we quit with that series. The other one, Helen sent me out to the West Coast at one point to see what was going on out there in the way of information, documentation research. And I visited people like Don Swanson and Harold Borco and Bob Hayes and Carlos Quadra. And I saw the Magna Card and all of that, RAND Corporation and System Development Corporation and Magnavox. It was a very interesting trip. And when I came back with reports of what was going on, that served to suggest that we should publish these research reports, and that was the current research and development. And over time, that got to be a big project, because trying to get people to submit their descriptions of what they were doing and coordinate the preparation. And finally, the Herner and Company took on the last, I guess, six or so under contract with the
Now, Helen. Essentially, both of these were your idea, the non-conventional systems and the research.
Yeah.
And you were responsible
for And I was responsible for producing them. What I went to work, what did we decide, 1956?
56, uh-huh.
And I joined Dick overseas I stopped working full-time.
62, I have you went overseas.
Yes, well, I was overseas by then. 60, went over in the spring of 61. But I was under contract with the Science Foundation until, I guess, 62. And then I was reviewing material for Helen, and I was looking at drafts of current research and so forth. But it was, the distance was too great.
Yeah.
And she wrote me a very nice letter saying that Bert Atkinson felt that it just wasn't productive, for that kind of distance. So I came back from overseas, and we came back in October of 63 and lived in Aberdeen. And I came down one time to a local chapter of ACES dinner meeting, and saw Mary Elizabeth Stevens. And she said, "I want you to come to work for me like you did for Helen Brownson. Long distance, and so forth." So I said, "I'd be interested." She was working on a book, the title of which is almost as long as the book itself, Cooperation, Convertibility, and Compatibility Among Information Systems. And Cy Newman was helping, and John Moats, I think his name was. And it just wasn't getting done. And she said she wanted me to come and help put it together, finish it, and so on.
Could I stop you there, and let's come back to that story in just a minute? Because
yeah.
I have a number of other questions about the NSF work.
Okay.
But I'm glad you got us to that point.
Yeah.
Now, in my view, this is the really critical period for the development of information science. That you were in the office funding the stuff.
Yes, yeah.
Doing the summaries. Talk to me about discussions, arguments, whatever was going on within your office at NSF about these terms, scientific documentation systems, scientific information systems, science of information, and information science.
Yeah. Several people questioned us about why were we the Office of Scientific Information. And Alberto's title of Office of Science Information was more accurate, because the National Science Foundation was interested in science information. And if you say scientific and technical, but if you just say scientific information, some people wanted to quibble and say, what's scientific about information? And we would
now, who
say,
changed that name from science information? Is this what something Atkinson did? When
I don't know
director?
Whether it was Atkinson or the Science Foundation management,
okay.
It went from science information to scientific information, and then I believe scientific information services, OSIS, or systems, I'm not sure which it was, but the I thought it was Office of Science Scientific Information Services. Do you?
Could be. No, yeah. I didn't keep
but
track.
But OSI became OSIS.
Okay.
And I think one of the problems was that scientific information bothered people,
mm-hmm.
but scientific information services made it seem more like science information.
mm-hmm.
But this was part of that. That's what I remember about it, that I can remember somebody, and I don't remember who it was, but it was somebody that was given to arguing, you know, and asking belligerent questions, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
Why do you call it scientific information? What's scientific about information? Mm. You know, that kind of thing.
What is your first memory of when folks began to use the term information science, particularly in the context of NSF?
I don't know that I remember using information science at NSF. Gene Garfield was the one that wanted us to change the name of ADI to ASIS, wasn't it?
No, don't remember.
I don't know. But maybe he wanted to change ASIS to something else. I don't remember. But I don't remember people talking about information science as such. There was a problem with the computer types when we talked about information systems, and they meant computer-based number crunching systems,
right.
And we were talking about library type, you know, bibliographic data.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, now, were you happy with the term documentation?
It yes, it seemed to. I have to tell you, I kind of grew up with it, so I never thought too much of it.
Yeah.
It was just. I think that some. Now, what did the people in Europe were talking about informatics? I never.
Not till much later, I think.
Yeah.
They were pretty ensconced with the term documentation.
Documentation, yeah.
Certainly during the 50s,
yeah.
The period we're talking about.
And otherwise, I thought we were in information processing, but not the same way, not thinking about it as the computer types did,
uh-huh.
you know, information
uh-huh.
processing.
So you didn't have a view one way or the
no.
other?
No.
Well, what about philosophy and funding? What was guiding, what was the central philosophy in funding various projects?
In the Program for Documentation Research, we would get proposals and look at them. There was, we had Richard C., S-E-E, was on our staff, and he was particularly responsible for mechanical translation research, keeping track of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We'd get, sometimes we would get proposals that just didn't seem to say a lot, you know. You could turn down a proposal on the basis of not well thought out, or not valuable, or not either too expensive, or too small and specialized a project for us to consider. Helen kept in touch with Wooster and I tell you, up at Rome Air Development Center, there was research going on that was sponsored. They sponsored research as well as did it. Larry Buckland was up there. We had staff meetings at which we would discuss different proposals, you know, and decide that. And whenever you're looking at proposals for support, you're looking at what are the other sources of support. You know, who else has been putting money into this? Who else could put money into this, and that sort of thing. One of the problems, I think, with the chemical abstracts proposal, although it was an example of the best of information processing, you know, collecting and analyzing and indexing and publishing indexes and so forth, it was a better off operation than a lot of them, but it was in our estimation a, you know, kind of a national treasure that could be supported and would become an example or a model for other information systems.
What or who gave you the confidence in that? Was just aside from Chem Abstracts itself, as you say, the national treasure, somebody?
I think that Helen was a good manager of our program and made good decisions, but it was the whole office cooperated in examining these different proposals, especially the big ones, you know,
like the Chem Abstracts.
Yeah, like the Chem Abstracts. I think that Bert Adkinson certainly had input.
Did Adkinson have a different philosophy or viewpoint in terms of funding from NSF and than Helen Brownson?
Not that I am aware of. I don't remember any kinds of push and pull or tug and resist kind of of attitude.
Would you describe Adkinson as a hard worker in this area, or was he more the show type?
I never worked with him that much because by the time he came on board and got fully integrated into the system, I was working part time with Helen, or 58. Our first daughter was born in 1958, and by that time I was living in Aberdeen, so that I had already been probably.
It had been there 2 years. He came in. I have that he became director in 59.
Yes, and I was there, and I definitely worked under him and through Helen, you know, with him, but through Helen. So I did not get involved in a lot of the, if there was any, office politics, okay? But I was doing...
You weren't in Washington full-time then?
No. Not from... Not from... 55, 56...
Well, you started in 56.
Six, yeah. And and went back to Aberdeen in, I was living in Aberdeen in 58. So I was probably about 2 years, because our daughter was born in September of 58, and I think I moved up to Aberdeen in July or August.
And then working part-time?
Yes. And then and coming down once or twice a week and doing a lot of work at home and so forth. And a lot of that was the current research reporting type of thing.
Well, let's talk about the Kim Abstract grants. 62, you were...
I was overseas in 62.
That's right, you went over 62.
Yeah.
Did you... Was there discussion about these grants before 62?
Yes, it seems to me... Was the first grant made in 62?
I think so.
Yeah.
$190,000 I have in 62.
Yeah.
You don't remember preliminary discussions that you were involved in?
No, we talked to people. There was a lot of activity at that time, if you remember, on and the Science Foundation, and probably Helen sponsored some of these studies of a national information system.
Right.
And I think that some of that the Crawford report and who did the people in System Development Corporation did a big study on a national information system. I remember more of that kind of thing and that kind of activity going on than I do a lot of.
You heard about the Kim Abstracts, let's say, disagreements with Garfield being one of those objecting to that, I guess, later on then,
rather than
at the time.
And if there had been some preliminary discussion and the word got around, Gene could have been protesting before the before any grant, you know, because he felt he had his Index Chemicus, which was never really a rival of Chemical Abstracts, but it was a complementary publication. And he just felt that he was being overwhelmed by the competition, you know, the rich get richer and the poor get kids kind of thing, you know.
Well, I've heard him say, you know, CAS got the nonprofit organizations could get the grants and I couldn't as a profit organization.
Yes. So he established the Institute for Scientific Information.
Well, I think it was always for profit oriented, though. Even so,
well, yeah. But I.
Oh, with a different name.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I'm not sure, but it seems to me I can remember him saying that you know, if I'm a.
He did later get some NIH money, so. I don't know what the problem would have been in terms of dealing with that. Well, since I was out and interviewed Dale Baker about that, I wondered, but what I read was that NSF considered the results of the grants made to CAS for the automation to be one of their pride and joys.
It certainly was a visible product. certainly a visible project.
Mm-hmm.
And it was well conducted and well documented and successful.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know who would have called it a pride and joy, you know.
One of
their bright stars, I don't know.
This was in a news account in Chemical Engineering News when the suit between Dialogue and CAS took place.
Okay.
And quoting some NSF official. And
Now
this is not until 93, is that when?
Yeah, that
or ended in 93.
Well, there's another example of somebody suing the competition, or at least beefing about the competition.
Yeah.
Huh?
What did you think about that? Did you follow that suit?
Yes. Chemical Abstracts has always had a certain attitude of superiority that can gall people. You know, they were the only kid on the block for so long, and now they have really an investment in a very sophisticated, competent system, right?
Mm-hmm. All powerful,
yes, and yet it seems to me that they could be a little more open to cooperative undertakings, okay?
Well, I found it a bit ironic in that Dialogue suing CAS because they had gotten public money when Dialogue software was built with public money.
That was the old NASA recon,
right,
yeah.
And I didn't know if you.
Whatever happened? Did they finally settle, or are they still?
They settled in 93, I believe, and spent an estimated $2 or $3 million on lawyers' fees.
Exactly.
And
nobody won but the lawyers.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it was sad. I never saw that brought up, the fact that Dialogue had gotten their software written with NSF money and
but
Air
it was
Force
it's
money.
Certainly the very rudiments of their software they
right.
went on to
yeah.
They went on to develop it, certainly far beyond recon.
Yeah.
But the ACS is really a big business, but it's a not-for-profit organization. And Chem Abstracts is a big business, but it always was buried, if you will, in the ACS, and so it could...
Oh, yeah. Well, 1,300 employees.
Oh, yeah.
And Dale Dakert said in his interview that ACS alone holds $100 million in reserve funds.
Is that right?
As a result of money
of
from
money
CAS.
Money from CAS, yeah.
Mm, we're talking no small amount of money there.
No, exactly. No, it's a big business,
yeah.
and it never wanted to...
well, you use the word... uppity. That's the common word.
Yeah.
Was that the? And I think that's what Dr. Garfield feels about them too. That they were just so
superior. Yes,
right.
They were so superior to. And part of that is the fact, I believe, is the fact that for so long they were the cream of the scientific information services.
Mm-hmm.
They did, and when I was a chemist, and before I worked for Perry, I used to do abstracting, for Chem Abstract.
You were one of the volunteers?
Yes, they had volunteers, you know, and we were dedicated. We would get our material and process it right away and send it back, you know?
Yeah.
It was part of being a giver of support for Jay Crane was a dear man, the editor of Chem Abstracts, and Perry and I worked closely with him and with Charlie Bernier on any way that we could help with Chem Abstracts, but they had a production line, you know, and they really, until they established a research division, they really weren't moving with the times, if you will. Charlie Bernier was quite proud of the fact that he could dictate his index entries into a dictating machine, you know, and have them typed out and look them over and so forth. That was so much more efficient than having to write them down on little cards.
Well, did you follow those various research directors of CAS? Like Bernier, I believe, was the first one, or maybe Carl Hohmann. Human was the first.
He might have been the first one. He went from CBCC to and Carl was a very nice person, and but not strong enough to make a difference. You know, to really set the world on fire with research direction. Malcolm Dyson, I think, was just there for prestige and to see if they could adopt his notation system.
Well, who really made the difference then?
Ron Wigington might have done some good things there. I'm trying to remember who were the...
Fred Tate.
Oh, Fred Tate. He was the one. Fred knew where Chem Abstract should go, and he was going to see that they got there. You know, he was a strong character.
Yeah.
Carl.